No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. And if you have a question or comment, you can call in at 888-627-6008. Tomorrow, on August 28th, is the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington. Tonight, we're lucky enough to have with us Dr. Frank Smith, a former member of the D.C. City Council, a former member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and someone who was at the very first march and has been a civil rights leader in Washington, D.C. for the last 60 years. So we're so happy to have you with us tonight, Dr. Smith. Welcome back to the show. You've been on the show before, so thanks so much for being with us.
Well, I'm always glad to be on the show with you, Senator Brown, and thank you for all you do to try to make the District of Columbia a state.
Well, let me ask you, let's start with the original march. You know, you're in the Washington Post today, looking dapper as ever. You know, you ought to be the poster child for coming to Washington, D.C., because it's, you're just looking so great. But anyway, I want to talk about a few of the quotes that you have in the Washington Post. I think that's a good place to start. You say at one point, for example, we marched about 2.5 miles from the SNCC office. We marched from Columbia Heights down 14th Street to get to the mall.
Right.
If people saw us marching down the street, hey, man, some of them got in line with us. They knew something dramatic and good was happening. So was there a great atmosphere of hope on that day? Was that a day where people were very hopeful about the future?
Well, let me just sort of back up for a minute on that particular march.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I came up here from the Mississippi Delta, from Greenwood, Mississippi, where I'd been arrested several times for trying to register people to vote. I'd seen Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer. I'd went over to get her out of jail and went on when they beat her so badly. Watched her and Ms. Ponder and other people come out of that jailhouse. And so, and then I'd been there when they bombed our offices, trying to intimidate us, and all kind of things that happened. So by the time I got to Washington, quite honestly, I was ready for a little R&R. But I did what everybody else would do. I didn't know Washington, D.C. that well. I think I know every blade of grass in Ward 1 right now, every tree, every block. I know somebody in every neighborhood.
Right.
But in those days, I was a stranger. I didn't know anybody. So I went to the SNCC office to see if I could round up two or three people, sort of, okay, how are we going to do this today? And everybody was sort of standing around. They didn't really have a plan either. So we decided to walk down there together. So we formed a group of about 8 or 10. Started out with 8 or 10, put placards and signs saying, you know, we want freedom, we want jobs now, and things like that. And as we walked down the street, we weren't really marching. We were just walking because we didn't have a permit. Walking down the sidewalk, people started joining us. And by the time we got down there to the mall, it was 10 or 12, it had become about 40 or 50 people. And we were a group. We were a group. We were looking for our rights. And it was kind of interesting because we were an organized group. As we walked toward the Lincoln Memorial, the crowd was already gathering, but they saw us come and heard us sing. They sort of moved back like we were part of the program. Let us march all the way down to the very front of the podium, where we stood for a minute, And then our leader, John Lewis, got up and waved at us. And then I went off to the left to find me a shade tree. I was hot by then and bothered and sweaty. And I don't know, we didn't bring any water with us and stuff. So I was getting ready to try to preserve the rest of the little bit of energy I had. But it was a dramatic moment for all of us because we had no idea how many people were going to be there. We were shell surprised by a sea of humanity, blacks and whites and Hispanics and Catholics and all these people who were out there to sing and pray with us about freedom.
Well, yeah, it must have been. I mean, it was a surprise to everybody, wasn't it, how many people showed up? Well, that it was a real turning point in the civil rights movement. We all know that. It was a pivotal moment when Dr. King gave up his speech. Wasn't his speech extemporaneous, most of it?
What people are saying is that he made bits and pieces of it before, once, I think, in Detroit at some meeting and places. And then there was a... somebody that it might have been Mahalia Jackson or somebody who I understand was saying to him as he was talking, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. Yeah. And so that's when he sort of got into it. But you know, he was a good Baptist minister. He knew how to draw everybody into the crowd. He knew how to paint a great picture. And you know, at one point, for example, he said that some of you have come here from the hills and mole hills of Mississippi, from those jailhouses, the smeltering jailhouses of Mississippi. And in my little group, everybody yelled, hey, so everybody would know who we were. And he was talking about the mole hills of Alabama and the various places. And then he talked about these units that had come out of sweatshops where they weren't being paid a living wage. So he had a way to draw everybody into his vision of this dream of America.
And isn't that one of our problems with D.C. statehood? I really think this is a problem that we have, is that we haven't been able to draw people in. We haven't been able to make them feel our pain. You know, obviously, when you're talking about the molehills of Mississippi, and it resonated with black people, you know, all the black people that were there.
What?
People just don't feel our pain, right? Because we're the only people in this particular situation, and we have a hard time drawing them in to make them understand, you know, to make it. And I think it's hard for them to feel sorry for us because we're a wealthy community that does well, you know. But yeah, I wish we could find a way to draw them in the way Dr. King was able to draw people in. You know, the most amazing thing about Dr. King, I think, is that he changed the world, and he died at 39 years old. You know, he was a young, very young man when he was murdered.
Well, he didn't. You know, I like to tell people, Senator Brown, he didn't die; he was killed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is when you say your prayers and say goodbye to your friends, lay down at night, pull your covers up, and then wake up in heaven the next day. Dr. King had not intended to go that night. He was getting ready to go to a meeting, and he was getting ready to lead a march there, and he was gunned down by some coward who was laying in the bushes waiting for him. I think that was one of the reasons why the nation rose up the way it did. If Dr. King had died in his sleep, I don't think he would have rioted and demonstrated and burned down these cities and villages and stuff like that. But because he was so brutally murdered by somebody that we knew was somebody who was trying to send a message. He was trying to send a message to all of us who were trying to do good, that we better stop doing good, or this might happen to us. If he could get King, maybe get anybody. And, of course, you know, they'd already gotten President Kennedy, they'd already gotten his brother Bobby, they'd already gotten Edgar Evers, Mississippi. And so it was an awful moment. But, you know, as in the great order of the universe, Senator Brown, as you know, God always has a mysterious way of making things happen for the good. Dr. King's death created a whole dynamic in these cities. Washington, D.C. becomes Chocolate City after that riot because a lot of whites moved out of here. Some blacks moved in, but mostly. And so you get these, and not just in Washington, D.C., but all across the country, you get these black mayors of these cities in Atlanta, Georgia. I was just in Atlanta last week, Friday. They turn these cities around. These cities become stepping stones for African Americans who are looking for employment in meaningful places, as they can now get jobs and employment in these municipalities that have very large forces. D.C. had 30 or 40,000 employees. Now we still have 48,000 employees in the city of Washington, D.C. If you add up all the police officers, the firemen, the teachers, the garbage workers, good union jobs that black people were barred from them. Black people were barred from those good jobs in Washington, D.C. before we were able to get the political, the limited amount of home rule. I'm going to say it's limited home rule. It is limited, no question about it. It's limited home rule. But I think that the tragedy of what is happening here is that we are second-class citizens. We pay first-class taxes. We have first-class participation in the wars with our children and our grandchildren. But we have second-class citizenship. We have to send our money to the government in taxes, but we don't even get to vote on whether there's going to be a war or not. The other states get to vote. We get to participate.
It's outrageous.
We pay our taxes, but we don't get to say how Congress votes on how to spend the taxes. We don't have a vote in the Congress about how they use our money. So
right,
it's a hard pill to swallow.
Yes, and they're after us these days. You know, as you well know, they've overturned a couple of pieces of legislation for the first time in 33 years. And, you know, they're trying to make they're trying to use the district, which they do from time to time, right? In addition to all the injury, they add insult by using us kind of as a whipping boy to hold us up and say, you know, this is what happened. The Democrats are soft on crime, for example. That was their mantra during the crime bill. But let me ask you, how far do you think we've come, Councilman? How far have we come? We just had three black people murdered in Jacksonville in a Dollar General store yesterday. It was some racist walked in and murdered three people after trying to go on the campus of a black college and where he was turned away. How far have we come? Are we regressing at this point?
Well, you know, Michael Brown, I was interviewed yesterday at the march by a young woman who is a video reporter from she lives in France, Paris, France, because she was born in Algeria. And she made a comment she said, we tend to see the world from where we are now, where we were born and where we live. And so the young people today that are born, my children, my grandchildren, never experienced the days when we had to ride the back of the bus and we had to sit in segregated cars but we were barred from going to school. Black kids and white kids were barred from going, right here in Washington, D.C., as well as in the South. And so when you measure the world from my perspective, I was born in Georgia in 1942. I'll be 81 next month, if God's willing. On the 17th of next month, I'll celebrate 81 years. So, and then I lived through all those years of Mississippi and the Civil Rights Movement. So I've seen a lot of things happen here. I've got grandchildren who have never been in segregated schools. All their life, they've been in schools that were integrated. And let me make another point about why I'm on that subject. When I was at Morehouse College, 1956 to 1969, the year I was in college, I ran at Morehouse. There were a total of 250,000 blacks in all the colleges combined in the United States. All the colleges, Morehouse, Howard, Spelman, Mars Brown, Savannah State, Albany State, colleges in Texas. And most of these black, historically black colleges were in the South. If you count Howard as being part of the South, all of them were south of Washington, D.C., all the way down to Texas. And there was one up in, I know, up in somebody's going to correct me on this. There's one at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, and there was a Lincoln out in Missouri, I believe. But most of those 250,000 students were in those schools. Today, there's over 3 million African Americans enrolled in colleges in the United States. Our income is going up exponentially because we believe in education. When I was coming up on that plantation in Georgia, my father had rules. If he went to work, I had to go to school. Everybody in his house. because he knew there was no future for me out there on that field, no fields picking cotton and corn and tobacco. My future had to be related to me getting a better education than he had. So all of his kids went to school. We all did well. Our children all doing well, our grandchildren. And so I talk about how many kids are enrolled in college because that's how we have reclaimed our part of this American dream. So you see, as our income is going up and as our educational level is going up, our income is also going up. And so my advice to parents and grandparents today, and I'm a great grandparent, is send your kids to school. Find a way to get them into school, get them into higher education. It's the only chance they've got. So if you look at the black community that way, we've made great progress. The signs are gone. There's no more black and white. You can't go here. You can't go there. Schools are integrated. In many cases, black people now are the sheriffs and mayors of these little towns in Mississippi and Georgia. And because they have taken over some of the leadership in the correction area, the sheriff I just saw today on television in that county down in Florida where that young man killed those three people in that racial attack there, sheriff of that county is an African-American. And that may be the reason why he killed himself, because he knew he was going to be hunted down by a black sheriff.
Yeah,
and he didn't want that to happen to him. So if you look at it that way, Senator Brown, we made substantial progress. Don't let me forget to say, we also elected Barack Obama president of the United States, not once but twice. And let me just put a point like that: at the time President Obama gets elected president of the United States, there's only 17 million black people registered to vote in the United States. Now, that's a far cry from the 700,000 that were registered to vote when I started to work in Mississippi in the 1960s. 2008, there was over 17 million. But he needed almost 60 million people to get elected president.
Yeah.
Now, I've been elected here a few times. You know, I was a councilman here a few years, 16 years.
Yeah, 16
If you got 16 and you need 60, 16 is better than nothing. But it's not enough to win with. So how does he win? He has to reach across the aisle, find enough whites, enough Hispanics, enough gays, enough people who are willing to judge him, as Dr. King says, by the content of his character rather than the color of his skin. And he gets elected not once but twice. So if you depend on how you measure progress of black people in the United States. And then, there's no way to account for these awful acts of violence where people like that man down in Florida just goes into some place and decides he's gonna kill black people. It's just awful, and it does happen too often. And I think the politics of the world that we live in now encourages that kind of thing, which makes us all fearful. And we should be fearful of it because we need to get this kind of mentality out of our society so we can all have a good place, a safe place to live.
Well, you know, I find it frustrating what you're talking about with the younger generation. My children, I remember going to Louisiana, to New Orleans with my parents when I was 10 years old. And I remember black and white water fountains. And I remember going to a restaurant in Alabama, which said members only. And I said to my father, yeah. Dad, it's members only. And he said, don't worry, son, we're members. And it was, and I thought, well, that's pretty cool, right? That he belongs to this, all these places, you know. And it was years later that I realized that, you know, when the guy opened the door, you know, what your membership card was that you were white. My kids act, when I say things like that to them, and they're grown now, my oldest daughter's 30, but they act like it's ancient history. Like this is something that happened 1,000 years ago and they don't get it. Is that part of the problem that we've got right now, especially when you have people like DeSantis who don't want to make white people feel uncomfortable, right? So they don't want to teach about the civil rights movement. Is that part of our problem now? Is it that people don't understand the great pain that black people went through?
Well, let me try to send a message to Mr. DeSantis down in Florida today. It was when the young people, high school kids, started to demonstrate the civil rights movement that we knew we were going to win this fight. First time I met Marion Barry, the former mayor of Washington, D.C., we were both young civil rights workers in a little town in Mississippi, and we were debating whether we were going to lead a group of high school kids in a demonstration in that town. And the reason why we were concerned about it was because sometimes you led a demonstration, the police officer would arrest all of us because we were over 18. If the kids were under 18, they were juveniles. So they would try to arrest us for contributing to the delinquency of juvenile by encouraging these kids to break the law by marching and picketing and demonstrating. So we were debating whether we wanted to catch that charge in this little town, which meant we were going to end up staying there for a long time. And while we were talking, we hear some kids coming down the street singing. These kids have shut the whole school down, elementary, middle, and high school. They shut the whole joint. They were all in the street, the teachers and everybody. They were marching down to the courthouse, basically. So you could, and I saw this same kind of thing happen in South Africa. Now, how are they going to stop these people who want to burn these books? The kids in these schools are going to rebel. You just wait and see. And we're going to thank Mr. DeSantis for this. Trying to crack down on these kids. First of all, he can't do it anyway, because now they can go on the internet and read these books. And they've got banned book clubs that now have more readership than they ever had before. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And these kids are going to start demonstrating about the fact that they're being deprived of their right to learn by these crazy policies. And then we're going to thank Mr. DeSantis for bringing on the second revolution here in this country. And it's going to be black and white, Hispanic, gay, straight. All our young kids are going to come out of this generation. That's how this generation is going to get motivated. If you were to ask me to look back through the prism of 80 years of time and then try to look forward to what I think the immediate situation is going to look like, I think these kids are going to start to fight back in these schools. Young kids are going to start fighting back in these schools. And eventually our parents will get in there and help them, and their grandparents, like me, will get in there and help them. And they'll take over these schools and libraries and these book clubs and tell these people like Francis that they can't tell them what to do.
Wow. First of all, let me thank you for that, because my wife's a school librarian, and you know, she deals with this every day. But yeah, I think that you know, it's just incredible. I watched the debates the other day with the Republicans, and this is a party that's bankrupt. I mean, when every one of those guys on the stage raised their hand and said if Donald Trump was convicted of a crime that they would still support him, I was just amazed. Let me ask you, do we take how much responsibility do guys like me, liberal Democrats, how much responsibility do we have to take for Donald Trump? Have we failed the American people? Have we failed the American people? Is that why we have Donald Trump? Because look, I talk to Trump people and they say, we know he's a liar. We know he's molested women. We know all these things, but we just don't care. Do they not care because they think liberals are so much worse?
Well, Senator, I tell you, I was in Georgia last week, last Friday night on the 26th of August, two days ago. I spoke to the Cowichan County Democratic Club in a county that's about 80% Republican and 25% Democrat. And my the head of the Democratic Party is one of my relatives. He's inviting me down there to bring some hope and to those people. And I started my presentation by saying this, and I think we ought to always remember this. The reason why Trump was surrendering in Georgia 2 days before I got there was because the Democrats carried Georgia.
Yeah.
Remember, Trump lost Georgia. That's why he tried to steal it, because he had lost it. And not only did we carry Georgia for Biden, but we delivered those two senators now to give us control over the Senate. Ossoff,
right.
and the other senator, Warnock. First of all, I had to thank the people of Georgia, the Democrats of Georgia, for standing up. And then you've got the lady, Ms. Willis, down there who's trying to bring in the justice, the prosecutor. So let's thank those people who are still on the battlefield and who are still sweating this out, because it's not easy. That lady's being threatened now by Trumpites and these you know, all kind of things are happening down there. So we got to speak by them, because we got to keep them propped up, because we want to keep Georgia blue in the next presidential election. So we can defeat this guy. And let's claim all our victories, because we need those in order to tell our supporters who are still on the battlefield that they still have a mission, and we support them, and we appreciate what they're doing. Now, what we, you and I, have to do is to get this question of statehood for the District of Columbia at the center of what the Democrats are trying to do.
Yes.
Because if we had statehood in Washington, D.C., we wouldn't have had to depend on Georgia to give us two votes so we could stay in majority in the Senate. We would have two right here in D.C. that would give,
yes,
them, give them majority.
Yeah, we spent $800 million in Georgia making that happen. And you're right. You would have two liberal Democrats from D.C. That's pretty sure in the Senate, and you certainly have
absolutely
one in Eleanor Holmes Norton and whoever her successor was in the United States House of Representatives. It's look, you know, I've always respected Representative Norton. But after I took this job, I gained real respect for her. She works so hard. She works so hard,
right,
and she gets things done without,
right,
any power. Only through her finesse and her political acumen has she been able to get things done for the District of Columbia. It's such a hard job. We owe her such a debt of gratitude. But yeah, you're right.
Let me say something about Congresswoman Norton, too, because I met her in the Mississippi Delta. She was,
mm-hmm,
a law student, and she came to the South to Mississippi. And actually, she and I came that from to the March on Washington together. But I wanted to say something else about her. I run the African-American Civil War Museum in Washington, D.C. People in Washington know it because it's located right there at U Street and Vermont Avenue Northwest. We have the names of 209,000 black soldiers who joined President Lincoln in the Civil War, fight for our freedom. They gave us the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, the 14th Amendment that made black people citizens, and the 15th Amendment that established voting rights for blacks. And those amendments are still right now being talked about. As a matter of fact, I heard Donald Trump one time say that because that 14th Amendment establishes how you get citizenship in the United States, he's saying we ought to amend that because we don't think that works right the way we wanted to do. We want to change the 14th Amendment, which is crazy. If you go after the 14th Amendment, you might go after the 13th Amendment, too, which abolished slavery. But I wanted to say that when we got ready to build this monument, we realized because it's on federal land, we needed a congressional resolution to get it done. So I turned to my good friend, Congresswoman Norton, who I worry on the Hill, and the first bill that she got passed the Congress, that passed actually unanimously, too, by the way, was a bill to establish the African American Civil War Memorial. And she said, you know, she could, at that time, she could vote in committee. She introduced the bill, got it, steered it through the House, and got it passed the both houses of Congress, the House and the Senate. And so I think that people ought to know that she's very effective as a council member. If she's that effective without the right to vote and without a full Senate,
yes,
delegation to help her, imagine what she would be doing. But she had a full delegation and had voting rights and had some,
yes,
senators, voting senators who could help work for the District of Columbia. That's just one of the little things that I wanted to mention because, as I said earlier, we ought to give people credit for the things that they do because that's how we show young people that it is possible to get something done, even though we work against great odds here in the district.
Well, yeah, and let me just say to people that may be listening that if you visit the District of Columbia, going to the African American Civil War Memorial and Museum that Dr. Smith has established and runs is really it's really worth the trip. You know, it's one of the you know, hidden treasures of the District of Columbia, and there are many, but the African American Civil War Museum is not only an important piece of our history that Dr. Smith has preserved, but you guys are also involved in the community. I've been to so many community events at your venue, Frank. It's amazing. You still stay involved, and it's a very important part of our identity here in the District of Columbia. So I encourage anybody that comes to the district to come and see it. It's really worthwhile. Oh, and then after you're done, you can slip out on U Street and get some good food at some of the restaurants on U Street, right? Ben's Chili Bowl. Yeah, I see that they just had their big anniversary, and you know, and among the many women that I admire in Washington D.C., Mrs. Ali is right at the top of the list, right under Eleanor Holmes Norton. So
absolutely,
yeah, absolutely. She's a treasure. But let me ask you. When it comes to, you've done this great thing with the African American Civil War Museum, and you've established this part of our history that will now never go away because people will learn about it. What about tearing down the monuments that we're tearing down all over the especially the South? Is that a good thing? Are we erasing our history? Are we going to forget? I mean, I understand why people don't like Robert E. Lee, but shouldn't we remember what the Civil War was about? Are we homogenizing our history by doing this? I know you're a great historian, so what's your perspective on this? Should we be tearing down statues of Robert E. Lee and Jackson? And they renamed my kids' high school. My kids graduated from Wilson High School. It's no longer Wilson High School because he was a segregationist. What do you think about that?
Well, I have two thoughts about that. One of them I borrowed from my good friend who's now passed away, who wrote a book called The Lies My Teacher Told Me. And Jim Lowen, Lowen. Jim Lowen in his book said that there were more monuments to Nathan Bedford Forrest, who started the Ku Klux Klan, than there were monuments to Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
Now, let's think about that for a minute. What monument to somebody who started the Klan and fought with the Confederacy, tried to destroy the country and destroy democracy, that to somebody who gave his full measure, as he would say, that's Abraham Lincoln, that black former slaves join the army, put on their uniform, and walk out on these battlefields. So, the first question, that's the first question. The second question is, why do we name buildings after people? Let's say the bridges and roads, streets, and why do we name those buildings? Because we want to remind our people of somebody who did some good and noble act. That's the purpose for doing that. That's the purpose for doing it. So we can be reminded as we turn the corner and see a building, oh, that building is for somebody who stood up for democracy. They stood up for freedom. They stood up for voting rights. So now, the people who put these monuments up about Robert E. Lee and others, they want to remind the country of what they call the good old days. Those good old days represented slavery. And if you're a black person, you got one view of that. White people may have another view. For black people, slavery was a horrible institution. And there's nothing good we can say about it. So, but what I say also is this, and this, Lauren said this too, and I'm borrowing it from him. I don't want to claim it's my own. Lauren said, when these statues and monuments no longer represent the values that white people have, white people should take them down. Black people shouldn't have to take these monuments down. Black people shouldn't have to rename these schools and rename these roads and bridges.
Right.
When a majority of people in this country no longer see those things as things of value, they ought to replace them with something that does represent their values. Now, how do you get to that? It's a rocky road. It's a rocky road because I have a new, as part of our new exhibit, we're undergoing a $10 million renovation now at the African American Civil War Museum. So it's closed for the next 6 months. The monument outside is open where the names are. But when we reopen, we're going to have a statue of Abraham Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation. Signing the Emancipation Proclamation. So last week, some blogger wrote an article saying, aren't there enough Lincoln statues already? Why are we still putting these statues up? I thought we would stop doing this because we were taking statues down. Well, if you don't know the difference between Abraham Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation and Robert E. Lee, then you probably didn't go, you need to go to one of these historically black colleges so you get a little education. There's a big difference. And so, I understand what the debate is all about, and I think it has a place. And I'm happy to see that they're taking these things down all over the country. And not only they're taking them down all over the country, I'll tell you another quick story. Last week I had a visitor at the African American Civil War Museum from Austria. Austria's in Europe. It's just south of Russia. It's up this northern part above Germany. And so I ask, always ask people, well, what do you teach about Black America in your schools, in Austrian language, in your language? What do you teach? And she said, there's not very much being taught there now. But in the seventh grade now, in the last several years, they have started to teach Black history because of the Black Lives Matter movement. The Black Lives Matter movement went all over the world, and people were taking down statues to people like Forrester in the Congo, that Belgian Congo, Leopold, and others, because they represented slavery and oppression, and they were in those countries. So there were people of conscience in those countries who were taking down all those monuments and renaming schools and roads and bridges. Because they wanted to cleanse their culture of some of these things that had come to represent oppressiveness for Black people around the world. And I think a lot of that is because of two things. One, the Black Lives Matter movement, as I said before. The other thing is that I don't think you can underestimate the value of electing Barack Obama president of the United States. Once the United States is the richest, most powerful, most complicated government in the world today. There's no question about that. And for those people who still thought Black people couldn't do anything except pick cotton and shine shoes, he proved that we could run the most complicated government in the world. And not only did he prove we could do it, but in the face of what is happening now with Donald Trump, who followed right after him, by the way, he shows you how to run a government with dignity and respect, and then how to pass on that to the next person the way you're supposed to do it in America. And not start grumbling and fumbling around leading terrorist groups out here trying to overthrow the government because you don't like the results. That's not how we do things in the United States. Barack Obama is a good example of it. He's a good example. Donald Trump is a bad example. And there's a difference between the two. Now, you might say, well, you have to teach about both of them. Well, you may want to teach about both of them. But don't forget to make the distinguished difference between these two. What Obama did and all the presidents before him did was to have this orderly transfer of power from one president to the next. This is the first time in the history of this country that a president not only tried to overthrow the government, but he's going to end up in jail probably. If any one of these four charges against him stick, he's going to probably end up at least with a jail record. He may not go to jail, but he's going to have a jail record. And so let me ask you this, Senator Brown, because I've heard this being rumbled about out here now. If he gets convicted of a crime and Biden beats him, do you think Biden should pardon him from a sentence, not let him serve in jail? What's your thinking about that?
No, I certainly wouldn't do that. I don't suggest that. I don't think that he'll ever go to jail. I kind of empathize a little bit with the college professors that say, let's get him out of politics under the 14th Amendment and just get him to, let's convict him of the January 6th inciting that insurrection and then toss him out under the 14th Amendment, which would prohibit him from running for office again. I don't know that we want any retribution, but no, I wouldn't pardon him. If he's found guilty, I would let him twist in the wind. But I have a question for you. I have a question for you.
You answer my question first.
Okay.
So the only reason why the president would do this, President Biden, would be if he was trying to bring the country back together. This country is divided right now.
Let's say Trump got
30-40% of the vote. That's a lot of
Oh my God! Yes,
millions of votes, and you can't govern the country with that many people feeling like they're outsiders, and that they've been cheated, and they've been deprived of they have to feel like they've been in an honest fight, and if they win or lose, they have to accept the results, which is what we all do. I lost my last election. What do? You walk down the hallway to the guy that won the election and say, "Congratulations!
Congratulations!
Here's the key to the office." If you need anything from me, let me know. And I will tell you this right now. My staff did not want me to do that. This is when leadership takes place. And I tell, when young people ask me about running for office, I tell them this. Well, I say, you know what? The first thing you should think about as you think about running is, what will you do if you lose? It's heartbreaking. It's, nobody wants to lose. I don't like to lose at marbles. I don't like to lose. I play basketball on a bad knee. I don't want to lose then. I shouldn't even be out there. That's why I don't go out there much, because I don't like losing. Nobody likes losing. But in losing, we also teach our young people that when you lose, you have to shake hands with the person that they had a good game and play them again tomorrow. Maybe you might win the next day. And we teach our young people that who play sports and so it's an important tradition that we pass on that mantle from one to another. And it's also, I think, important. And having said all this. One of the things that happened after Abraham Lincoln got killed when the Civil War was over was that Lincoln was not around to figure out how to bring this country back together again after the Civil War. And they ended up with some guy with the Hayes-Tilden Compromise, Russell Lee Hayes, who was just awful. And they pulled these troops out. They forgave everybody and ended up with Jim Crow, with separate but equal, which was awful. I mean, I was born in a separate but equal in Georgia. It was separate, but it was not equal. So sometimes, you know, you have to think about these things. You have to think long term. I don't know if I would recommend that President Biden pardon him. I think he ought to suffer some. Anyway, under Georgia law, he would have to suffer some before he could be pardoned, because Georgia has a very strict law about pardon. You have to serve some time before you can be pardoned in Georgia.
Right, I know. Thank you. 10 years. And you know what?
Yep.
You've changed my mind. I agree with you. I agree with you on that, because that's one of the reasons I stand behind the idea of getting him out under the 14th Amendment, is you just get him out of politics. Don't worry about, again, because the country's so divided. Yes, you certainly have to deal with that. That's one thing that we've all done, right? We've agreed to this system of democracy. So it bothers me sometimes that liberals think of these people that, you know, as people that they don't have to deal with. Yes, you have to deal with them. We've got to work it all out. So let me ask you, because the first guy I worked for in politics was from Georgia. His name was Jimmy Carter, and he was a really, really nice guy. A really good human being. He's still a good human being, just barely hanging on from what I understand, but really good person. Maybe not the best president, but I think history will write that he was the right person after Richard Nixon. Is Donald Trump the person after Obama because of backlash? Is it backlash that we got Trump because we had Obama? And, you know, and I mean, I'm like you, Dr. Smith. I think Obama was an amazing president and was really a turning point in our history. But you think we got Trump in part because we had the first African-American president?
Well, let me go at this another way. I told you I was in Georgia last week. I spoke to the Cuyahoga County Democratic Clubs. A county that's about 70% Republican. So Democrats, they used to whisper that they were Democrats down there before Barack Obama. They didn't even want to tell people they were Democrats. But Barack Obama was such an exemplary president, especially now that they're thinking about it, you know, in retrospect, and they've got Donald Trump now to contrast him.
Yeah.
They are very proud of the fact I'm talking about white Democrats now in this county, which is dominated by Trumpites and right wingers. These Democrats now, they feel like they're in a fight for rights. They're in a fight to save the soul of America, and they're that's why these lonely people out in Georgia, and that's why they invited me down there, because they said we need somebody to come down here, pump us up a little bit, and I said I know how to do that. So, but they feel like they're doing something good in the moral sense. Because they're holding up those principles of freedom and democracy in a place where they know they're outnumbered, and they know they have to continue to fight. But their votes count. And this, I want to get back to this. Their votes count, because And my advice to them when I went down there when they were working for Warnock, I went down to work for him too, the Senator Warnock down in Georgia. And what I said to them after when the second time he ran, I remember he ran once, he was left 2 years, and then he had to run again after 2 years. So I said, okay, here's what we're going to try to do. We know we can't win. We're outnumbered 3-1 in the county altogether. But let's try to improve the last turnout by 10%. So we take every precinct and see how many votes we turn out in the first time, and now we're going to improve it by 10%. That means you got to take somebody to the polls with you when you go. And that way we can get our votes up, because at the end of the day, he carried that state by 11,000 votes. That meant every vote that we turned out counted toward that 11,000 that helped him to win the state. Remember, Trump is down there telling people, just find me a bushel of votes here and there and disqualify these. Because he's trying to get up to 11,000. There's a handful of votes in the state that cast almost 4 million votes. So everybody's vote counts. And I was really encouraged myself by these people, because I think that I believe that most Americans still believe in this system of democracy and freedom. I hear these people as far away as ours saying they're going to vote for him even if he's convicted and goes to jail. They're going to vote for him anyway. I don't believe that. And maybe it's because I don't think, I'm a black man. I can't just afford to believe that all of these people as far away as I would turn and are supporting somebody who's just so antithetical to all the things that we believe in. But I don't believe they'll vote for somebody with a criminal conviction. I don't believe that. And so we'll see. But I think though that we have I am shocked to see that there are this many people, 40 or 50 million people in the United States, who would even say they're going to vote for him, knowing full well that not only that he did all those things you talk about, him groping women and stuff, that was beforehand. Now he's got he led that mob that broke into the United States Capitol.
Oh no!
They tried a violent overthrow of the government. He led that mob. Said they were just peaceful protesters who were just exercising their rights. These people broke into the Capitol and put a noose looking for somebody to hang. That's not a peaceful protest. It's not by anybody's definition. Right. So it's just hard for me to believe people. But you know what, though? Those of us who believe in freedom can't stop, and those of us who believe in justice cannot stop, and we can't stop believing either. So let's keep on voting.
That's right. And that's what I say all the time when people say to me that we haven't gotten far enough in our push for statehood. I say, well, what are we supposed to do? You know, we can't accept sitting in the back of the bus. We need to keep pushing until we make it happen. And the difference between you walking down the hall and saying, congratulations, what can I do to help? And what Trump does is a matter of character. Leadership involves character. And that's what is so missing from this man. It's so disheartening to see that you and I both know, and those people on the stage, you and I both know, because we both run for public office, that it's hard sometimes to stand up and take a position that you know is not going to be popular, but you need to do it, right? The woman that walks up to me and says, what do you believe about right to life? Well, you know, when you answer that you stand up for a woman's right to choose, that she's not going to vote for you as she walks in the door. And it's hard to say that, but you have to say it. And that's one thing these people won't say. I don't think there's any character among any of those people that were on the stage, with the exception maybe of the guy that's from North Dakota. You know, he didn't raise his hands, or maybe he has something. Well, before I let you go, let me ask your perspective, because you were on the council for so many years. Are the politicians in Washington in trouble right now? Is the mayor in trouble? Is the council in trouble with the way things are going? You know, we have this ridiculous amount of carjackings with young people. I mean, babies, right? We had a 14-year-old shoot an NFL football player. It's getting crazy. Are we headed in the wrong direction here, or locally? Are we
Senator, I've been around here. I've been in D.C. now, you know, since 1968. I was in office for 16 years as a council member. Three years before that, the school board, that's 19. And before that, I was an advisory neighborhood commissioner. So I've been in elective office for over 20-some years here. And I'm pretty well known in some neighborhoods, particularly in Adams.
Yes, Morgan. You are.
My church is still over there, and I still have a lot of friends. So I was over there at a Starbucks a few weeks ago, and the guy who used to own the club called the Mumbo Room, a young white counterculture guy, but who probably was never registered in the Democratic Party because he was too radical. But he stopped me and said, you know, we haven't had a good government since you and Barry were in there. Why don't you run for mayor? I said, man, I'm 80 years old. I'm too old for that. It's young man's game. He said, yeah, somebody got to take over here. So I think there's a lot of that people feel like, you know what, we just, I think they feel like they don't get the respect that they deserve, that people never ask them what they think. They never ask them what they think. They just do things without asking them. And so there has to be some way to connect with that group, because I think people, and there's too much reliance upon these devices, computers and handheld devices that have all the registered voters on there. And when they call your office, your name pops up. If you're not a registered Democrat and hadn't voted in the last three elections, they might not answer the phone. So the government has become pretty far removed, and there's too much of that. There's too much of that going on in national politics, too. It's not just in local politics, but in national politics, too. So let me just say one other thing about that, since you asked me this, Senator Brown. The thing that really makes me more concerned than anything else is that when you say something about Trump being corrupt and all that stuff, what people say is, well, they're all corrupt. He's no more corrupt than anybody.
Right. Right.
They're all corrupt.
That's a problem.
And I've had people say to me, how did you get out of the government? All those years you spent there, nobody ever accused you of corruption. Well, you got away because you were smart. They never caught you. So they're still trying to say everybody's corrupt. It's hard for them to believe and get their heads fixed on the thought that you can have honest, honorable people serve in office. And that's because they expect more out of people who serve in office. And I believe this, and I think you're an example of this. I think you have to carry yourself a certain way if you're going to serve in office. If you're not going to do that, you shouldn't run. You shouldn't run. Because you're going to disappoint people if you're not willing to be honorable and respectful, and if you're not willing to walk away from that office when you lose and say, thank you very much. We didn't win this time. Maybe we'll win next time. Or like me, you may never run again. But you've got to be honorable enough so people not only believe in you and what they thought were your good characters, but also so they'll be able to trust somebody else. And I think that's what I hear about this presidential race is, and this is why I think Trump has a chance, because the public is real cynical. They're saying, well, he is no more he's no more corrupt than everybody else. And I was working for Hillary Clinton. I went out to Ohio with my wife to work for Hillary Clinton when she ran against Trump the first time. And I was working in a precinct out there that we knew was a swing precinct. They knew we didn't have a chance of winning this precinct. And by 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I started stopping these middle-aged white women that were coming in there and asking them why weren't they voting for Hillary? They wouldn't even call her name. They just said, well, we want a woman president one day, but not that woman.
Yeah.
So when I asked what was it that they had against her, they would say, well, they run a criminal enterprise. Well, hell, I mean, if what we're looking at now is not a criminal enterprise, I don't know what a criminal enterprise is. Now, if you ask me, would that same lady now vote for Trump, knowing all the stuff they know now about him being indicted and brought up on the charges, all of the House hearings, the Capitol break-in? That's why I think he's probably not going to win, because I can tell you right now, I had firsthand experience with P. I worked all day long for Hillary trying to get her elected. She lost primarily in the minds of those people because they thought she and Bill, they were saying was she and Bill Clinton ran a paid play government where people had to pay. And I don't think that was true.
No, me either.
It was true at all. Quite, I don't think, if I thought that was true, I would have been working for it myself. But I don't think that was true at all. But Trump has succeeded in getting these people to believe that they were corrupt and that he was not corrupt. Trump was not. He doesn't have that going for him this time. Because he doesn't have that going for him this time. So I think we can beat him. It's going to be tough. But I think that because of what I learned firsthand in that precinct out in Ohio, which he lost, by the way, big time. The state lost Ohio in that last election, in that big time election. So I think we're going to win. I think we will. But it's going to be tough because there's a lot of cynicism out there in the world.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we're out of time right now. But from your lips to God's ears, I hope that's the truth, Councilman. And let me just say that I don't care that you're about to turn 81. If you ran for mayor, I would vote for you. Thank you so much for being on the show. Frank Smith, Dr. Frank Smith, Councilman Frank Smith, you are a real treasure in the District of Columbia, and we very much appreciate all that you've done for the citizens of our city. And we're going to leave you tonight with a song. We always leave with a song, and this, of course, was the only choice for me. Joan Baez with We Shall Overcome, which she sang 60 years ago tomorrow. Everybody have a great week. Thank you so much for being on the show, Councilman. We'll talk again soon.
I enjoyed this very much. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Bye. See you next week. Thanks, folks.
Would you sing We Shall Overcome with me, please?
We shall overcome. We shall Give the people their right to vote.